dynamic if you vote for a low performing candidate that can't someone else that you would least want to win ends up prevailing. So it gives voters more choices and more power in determining the ultimate winner of an election.
And so when was it first instituted here in New York? The election is Tuesday.
Yeah, it was first instituted in our city elections in 2021. Under our rules here in New York, you can vote in order of preference for as many as five candidates. So you can, yeah, it's really changed the dynamic of the election here.
So, John Tarleton, editor-in-chief of The Independent. You can see the full interview online. Early voting goes through Sunday in the New York City primary for mayor. Primary day is Tuesday. That does it for our show. We're hiring a senior headline news producer, a director of audience, and a director of technology. You can find out more at democracynow.org/jobs. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, Anjali Kamat, Safwat Nazal. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grand, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland.
It's time to pack your bags and join us for Camp KBOO. Make a summer of memories with KBOO and support grassroots media by becoming a member today. Go to kboo.fm/give to help us reach our $50,000 goal by June 29th.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this summer membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News, a new bill in Oregon stops medical debt from affecting Oregonians' credit.
Protests against ICE continue.
And the Los Angeles Lakers are set to be sold to new ownership.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 20th, 2025. KBOO is currently in our summer membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Sam Bowman. Wednesday night and Thursday morning, at least seven people were arrested at the ICE facility on Southwest McAdam Avenue in Portland. Federal agents and Portland Police Bureau reported very different stories of what happened. The Department of Homeland Security posted on X, quote, "Portland rioters violently targeted federal law enforcement. 250 rioters launched fireworks, shined lasers in officers' eyes to temporarily blind them, and stormed an ICE field office," end quote. Federal officers wore full riot gear with gas masks and deployed tear gas, otherwise known as CS gas, flash grenades, pepper bullets, and rubber bullets and other projectiles onto the protesters. PPB reported that it was a, quote, largely lawful gathering, end quote. Protesters are suffering from gas exposure despite many wearing KN95 or gas masks. Many protesters have suffered injuries from the, quote, less lethal projectiles. A nurse who went to protest the ICE raids last week was shot in the eye and almost completely lost his vision.
Oregonians will no longer have their credit scores affected by medical debt. Thanks to a new bill, SB 605, that has just been signed into law. Consumer protection advocates say soaring medical costs have landed nearly one in three Oregon residents in debt. Isabel Charlet has more on the story.
A bill prohibiting credit reporting on Oregonians' medical debt has been signed into law by Governor Tina Kotek. Hailed as a significant victory for consumer rights advocates, the bill also removes existing medical debt from credit reports, including debt from medical credit cards. High medical costs have forced nearly one in three Oregonians into debt in the last 2 years alone, causing cascading financial harms long after bills are paid. Adam Zarin with the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society says the cost of treating leukemia, for example, is almost $500,000, much of which becomes debt.
So an individual like that might now be able to stabilize their life, get the job they want, start a business, get a line of credit to move on with their life without the kind of financial burdens you get from medical debt.
Three major credit reporting agencies have already taken steps to remove some medical debt from people's credit reports voluntarily. Oregon will be the 14th state to implement similar legislation, which is set to take effect next year. Chris Coughlin with Oregon Consumer Justice says it's not fair that people's ability to rent an apartment or buy a car would be impacted by debt that they didn't choose to take on or may be inaccurate.
Sometimes people get sent to collections for debt that's not theirs through the healthcare system.
On the federal level, Coughlin warns that protections for medical debt and credit reporting, once enforced by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, have now been revoked by the Trump administration.
Now it's more important than ever for states to take action to protect Oregonians. And so we're really happy that this bill has moved forward.
Zarin adds that with cuts to Medicaid looming in the future, it is likely that more Americans will lose healthcare, including over 220,000 Oregonians, resulting in increased medical debt. Coughlin adds that it's yet another reason for states to enact policies to protect their residents. I'm Isabel Charlet, Oregon News Service.
Children from lower-income families could soon be one of the hardest-hit groups if the Republicans' so-called Big Beautiful Bill is passed. In a recent letter, the Congressional Budget Office, or CBO, advised the bill could be a solid win for the wealthiest Americans, though it would eliminate resources for some of the poorest households in the United States. These cuts would be in part of an effort to help pay for an extension of Trump's 2017 tax cuts. Republicans in both the House and Senate want to reduce several safety net programs that provide an array of services for millions of children in the United States. One of the key programs they're looking at cutting is medical assistance. If Republicans pass this bill, more than 37 million children face losing medical coverages under Medicaid or Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP. Combined, both programs protect nearly half of the children in the United States and cover over 40% of U.S. births and nearly half of the children born in rural areas. Congressional Republicans are proposing longer wait times before families can enroll into these programs, nationwide work requirements, which include a work requirement for parents of children over the age of 14. In addition to work requirements, Republicans are trying to enact other changes that would create hurdles for families administratively. House Speaker Mike Johnson has stated that there are no cuts to Medicaid in the Big Beautiful Bill, but the CBO estimates that the federal spending cut to the program would shed $800 billion over the next decade. The CBO has found that by increasing a child's enrollment into Medicaid, but by increasing children's enrollment into Medicaid would reduce the future of the federal deficit by between $800 and $3,400 billion per year of a child's enrollment. Among the other changes that are proposed would be to cut $290 billion from Supplemental Nutrition and Assistance Program, or SNAP. Such a cut could affect 2 million children across the U.S. and put the schools on the hook for up to 5 to 25% of the cost of food benefits. Cutting such a program would see a cost to even the wealthiest families of $12,000. Research has shown that cutting such programs takes away from providing for the most vulnerable children, puts them at a disadvantage, and that keeping such programs is an investment that will provide a lifetime of returns to the United States.
White House says decision on Iran strikes will come in 2 weeks. Conservatives in Congress demand answers on former President Biden's mental acuity, and a new lawsuit could change Maryland's primary election process. With that story and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
They had an opportunity to make a deal. They should have made a deal. President Trump's word means something. The world understands that. And at the Defense Department, our job is to stand ready and prepared with options, and that's precisely what we're doing.
Although Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth says the Pentagon has military options ready for use against Iran, the White House says President Donald Trump will decide whether to use them within 2 weeks. Iran and Israel are still exchanging missiles, and Israel's defense minister says Iran's supreme leader, quote, should not continue to exist. Israel lacks the bunker buster bombs that might be able to reach Iran's underground nuclear facilities, but military observers say making sure those facilities are destroyed might still require on-the-ground troops. In his first term, Trump pulled out of the multilateral disarmament deal reached under President Barack Obama. Intelligence officials now disagree on how close Iran may be to getting nuclear weapons. Hegseth blames Joe Biden's administration for not reining in Iran's nuclear program. Conservatives in Congress want an investigation into Biden's mental acuity. The book Original Sin accused members of his inner circle of covering up his decline. Although presidents have used auto pens to sign documents for decades, Missouri Republican Senator Josh Hawley says he wants proof Biden authorized its use.
Show us the documents where the president authorized the use of the pen for every single pardon, clemency, and stay application. Let's see it. Let's see all of it. And if you won't do it, we should subpoena those documents, and we should find out the truth of who was really running the White House.
Trump has argued, without citing support, documents Biden signed with an auto pen are invalid. Democrats walked out of a congressional hearing on Biden's mental state, calling it a publicity stunt. After being arrested at a Homeland Security press conference, California Democratic Senator Alex Padilla is describing how he came to be there. Padilla says he'd been trying unsuccessfully to get answers from Secretary Kristi Noem's office about why the Trump administration sent troops to Los Angeles. Padilla says he was down the hall for an unrelated meeting when he heard about the press conference and decided to ask her in person about policies he calls shocking.
United States Secretary of Homeland Security said that the purpose of federal law enforcement and the purpose of the United States military was to, quote, liberate Los Angeles from our governor and our mayor.
He adds, when governor of North Dakota, Noem said if Biden federalized the National Guard, it would violate states' rights. A new lawsuit challenges Maryland's closed primary system, which bars nearly a million unaffiliated voters from the Democratic and Republican primaries. The Open Primaries Education Fund, a plaintiff in the lawsuit, argues general elections would become more competitive when candidates are selected by a wider electorate. And Jeremy Gruber with the fund says open primaries are more democratic.
This lawsuit is meant to address a situation where publicly funded and administered elections, which primaries are shutting out American citizens.
Supporters of the closed primary system argue it ensures only dedicated members of a political party vote for a nominee, and it prevents an opposing party from influencing another party's nomination process. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You are listening to a summer membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $50,000 by June 29th. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be a little rainy with a high of about 59 and a low of 51. And tomorrow it will be rainy also with a high of 57 and a low of 54. But the weekend will warm back up on Sunday for a high of 75 and some sunshine with a low of 52 degrees. Today in 1910, American blues musician Howlin' Wolf was born in West Point, Mississippi. The quote of the day is from Howlin' Wolf. He said, quote, I may be a howling wolf, but I got a heart full of love.
A new welcome center in the town of Blue River, Oregon, had its grand opening last week. With that story and more, it's Brian Bull with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. A new welcome center in the town of Blue River, Oregon, had its grand opening last week. The Mackenzie Crossing and Native Center is located in the geographic heart of the 9 federally recognized tribes in Oregon. It's also in an area hit by the 2020 holiday farm fire.
I wanted to create something up the Mackenzie River and Blue River to help it heal.
Catherine Kia Wilson is a bicultural liaison for the center, with connections to many tribal communities, including Native students she's mentored at the University of Oregon's Longhouse. Although the grand opening competed with other events on June 14th, including the No Kings rallies, Wilson was pleased at those who made it.
We had over 50 people there, a wonderful celebration.
The center will show how many tribes crossed through the area for gathering, camping, and traveling to the Obsidian Cliffs along the coast. Wilson's grand plan is to establish a film center for Native people, where they can learn how to make original films.
At this point, I broke the ice, so to speak. And it's time for the tribes to step in. If they want this to happen, I'm here. But it's too big for this little old lady. But that was the dream.
Wilson says she's working with Native grant and business writers to make the film center a reality. And now we continue yesterday's story from KJZZ's Gabriel Piatrazio about how tribes along the Colorado River are faring under President Trump.
Uncertainty is still rippling from top to bottom, with So pointing out that the White House had yet to nominate a reclamation commissioner. That was until the Trump administration tapped Ted Cook, who once managed the Central Arizona Project, to potentially lead the Bureau.
They're still building out the political roster interior quite a bit.
Daniel Cordalis, who is also Navajo, runs the Tribal Water Institute at the Native American Rights Fund. Settlements are hugely important legal frameworks for tribes in securing their water rights by basically turning paper claims into guaranteed acre-feet allocations, along with the funding mechanisms needed to do so. Such agreements, largely bipartisan, can only be ratified by Congress.
And of course, tribal water rights are not the president's priorities. It's not uncommon. You know, that being said, I think we have an Interior Secretary who is sympathetic and supportive of tribes.
During his confirmation hearing, Interior Secretary Doug Burgum was hopeful he can deliver results for all along the Colorado River.
I've got some good understanding and good exposure to this, but I think you can count on that we're going to look for a collaborative solution that serves everyone.
But even if Burgum is behind tribes, getting the GOP-controlled Congress on board could still be challenging. Cordalis says slashing federal dollars may have a trickle-down effect, stalling Indian water settlements.
Congress is very much on the president's playbook about cutting costs, reducing the budget, and doing things and requiring, for lack of a better word, offsets.
The biggest offset of them all would be the Northeastern Arizona Indian Water Rights Settlement for Navajos, Hopis, and San Juan Southern Paiutes. It's worth $5 billion, an expense that the federal government incurs.
Where do you offset that? And who's going to do it? That's the concern here. These settlements have big price tags.
So is slightly more optimistic. She thinks the Trump administration sees this settlement for the three tribes in northeastern Arizona as an economic driver.
For the most amount of acres and the largest populations of tribes in the country.
The first Trump administration ratified the nation's most expensive Indian water settlement to date, valued at $1.9 billion.
That tells me, at least from the federal perspective, the first Trump administration understood the investment in Indian water.
But that all happened before Trump began focusing on so-called government efficiency. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Piatrazio.
And I'm Brian Bull in the KLCC studios of Eugene, Oregon.
As Minnesotans grieve the murder of State Representative Melissa Hortman and her husband, their family calls on the state to honor the couple's memory through community improvement work. Mike Moen has more on the story.
Minnesotans gathered at the state capitol last night for a candlelight vigil for State Representative Melissa Hortman after she was assassinated early Saturday. Those close to her hope her legacy inspires acts that benefit communities all over. Following the shooting attack that left Hortman and her husband dead, the couple's adult children issued a statement urging residents to honor their parents' memory in a variety of ways. One of them is to plant a tree. Anne Marie Hendrickson of the nonprofit Tree Trust says they accept donations to replant groups of trees in Twin Cities neighborhoods devastated by invasive species. She says Hortman's home city is a good fit.
We do have a relationship with Brooklyn Park. So, you know, maybe it's all the funds raised, for instance, as a result of their deaths could be used to replant trees in a Brooklyn Park park, and volunteers would be engaged to come out and plant those trees.
Hortman's 2 decades in the legislature, including several years as House Speaker, is being described as one of the more impactful careers at the state capitol. Lawmakers from both major parties have noted her strong commitment to improving the lives of Minnesotans. The family statement concluded with a request for people to do something, whether big or small, centered around community improvement. In northeastern Minnesota, Michael Nicklow runs the organization Let's Plant Trees, and he says they have plenty of volunteer opportunities, including memorial plantings.
It's a beautiful thing to do, to carry on that legacy, of course, and trees are a beautiful thing, not only for our generation, but for future generations mostly.
And Leanne Thiner co-directs the Worthington Christian Church Food Shelf. She says operations like hers could always use volunteers, with aging staff members stepping down. She says helping to ensure your neighbor has enough food to eat is an excellent way to show they're supported by their surrounding community, no matter the size of the volunteer job involved.
Volunteering at a food shelf is a very rewarding thing to do. The people come in here, and after you've gotten to know them for a while, you know, they come and say, hi, how are you doing? And they always say thank you.
This is Mike Moen for Minnesota News Connection.
Donald Trump posted a social media claim today, renewing his claim the 2020 election was stolen from him. He said, quote, the 2020 election was a total fraud. The evidence is massive. A special prosecutor must be appointed. This cannot be allowed to happen again in the United States of America. Let the work begin, end quote. Trump has on multiple occasions over several years claimed that Democrat Joe Biden only won the 2020 election because of widespread voter fraud. However, Donald Trump has not supplied any evidence backing that claim. In fact, evidence presented in courts showed this did not happen. Multiple judges, including some appointed by Trump himself, rejected more than 60 lawsuits with claims of widespread fraud or false, frivolous, or lacking standing or evidence. In addition, an Associated Press review of every potential case of voter fraud in the 6 battleground states disputed by Trump found fewer than 475 examples. That fraction of total voters would have made no difference in the 2020 outcome, even if every single one had been cast for Biden. The review also concluded there was no collusion to rig voting. Essentially, all fraud cases were individuals attempting to cast more than one ballot. Trump was indicted in 2023 by a Washington grand jury on charges stemming from his effort to remain in power after losing the 2020 election. Those charges were later dropped after he won the 2024 election. In fact, having a special prosecutor examine an election is nothing new. A special prosecutor in Biden's Justice Department investigated Trump's efforts to undermine the 2020 election, but that probe ended when Trump won back the White House in 2024. RollingStone.com is concerned Trump intends to fulfill a promise made to his supporters in 2023 that if he reclaimed the White House, he would appoint, quote, a real special prosecutor to go after the most corrupt president in the history of the United States of America, Joe Biden, and the entire Biden crime family, end quote.
As the world shifts its attention to Iran, Israel has increased aid site attacks on starving Palestinians. Every day, Palestinians travel to remote areas to try to get food for themselves and their families and are attacked, turning the so-called aid distribution sites into open killing fields. The death toll averages 40 people every day just this week. Over 400 have been killed and more than 3,000 wounded since late May at these sites. One man, Ahmad Nejim, is no longer able to walk after trying to get food from an aid site on June 11th, according to testimony he gave to Dropsite News. His cousin Abdulrahman was one of the many killed that day. Ahmad says that after hours of waiting in line for food, the Israeli army opened fire on them without warning. He says they were in the green area of the map that is supposed to be safe, and he does not know why they started firing. He also says that he went to the site fully aware of the risk. He was trying to get food no matter the risk because, he says, everyone is starving. The confirmed health ministry death toll since the start of the genocide now stands at over 55,700, a number acknowledged by many experts to be a mass undercount due to many thousands missing.
In sports news, a major National Basketball Association team is being sold, but they aren't going cheap. KBOO News reporter Josh Salem tells us more.
An incredibly famous sports franchise is about to be sold. The Buss family has agreed to sell their controlling stake in the Los Angeles Lakers to TWG Global CEO and Los Angeles Dodgers owner Mark Walter. The franchise valuation is $10 billion, the highest ever for a professional sports team. As part of the deal, Jeannie Buss, whose family has had control of the Lakers since her father bought them in 1979, allegedly plans to stay on as team governor. It's not actually clear how much more the Lakers Walter is acquiring. He was part of a group that bought 27% of the team in 2021. In fact, Jeannie Buss will still own at least 15% of the team once this transaction is carried out. By NBA rule, a governor must have at least that much of an ownership fraction. Walter and or TWG Global already had the controlling interest in the Dodgers, the Premier League soccer team Chelsea, the Professional Women's Hockey League, and several auto racing teams including Cadillac Formula One. LA Dodgers manager Dave Roberts said the sale marks, quote, a very exciting day for the Lakers, for the city of Los Angeles, end quote. Former Lakers legend Magic Johnson, a business partner of Walter's and someone said to be close to Jeannie Buss, said, quote, Mark Walter is the best choice and will be the best caretaker of the Laker brand. The proof is in the pudding on what he's been able to accomplish with the LA Dodgers, end quote. Walter is CEO of the financial services firm Guggenheim Partners, which is estimated to have more than $325 billion in assets. The agreement for the sale of the Lakers comes about 3 months after a potential Boston Celtics sale agreement. The Celtics had an initial valuation of $6.1 billion, which was already going to be a record. The Lakers have been in control of the Buss family for 46 years, the longest of any current NBA franchise. Herb Simon bought the Indiana Pacers, currently in the NBA Finals, in 1983. The second longest current ownership of an NBA club. Jerry Buss bought the Lakers for $67 million and made it to the NBA Finals 16 times out of his 34 seasons leading the club, winning 10 championships over that period. When he died in 2013, ownership of the Lakers went into a trust controlled by Buss's six children. The Lakers won their 11th title while under Buss family control in 2020, the franchise's most recent championship. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
No one had seen one in over a century. But thankfully, the discovery of a small surviving community in 2001 sparked environmental efforts across Southeast Asia. For more, here's Good News, Good Planet.
Good news, good planet, good news.
It's time now for your good news for a good planet. A royal rescue. The Southern River Terrapin, more commonly referred to as the royal turtle, once roamed the riverbanks of Cambodia, Malaysia, and Sumatra. Considered a delicacy and medicinal, these noble creatures were hunted to near extinction, their habitats destroyed by deforestation and illegal sand mining. No one had seen one in over a century. Thankfully, the discovery of a small surviving community in 2001 sparked environmental efforts across Southeast Asia. Governments, local communities, and conservation organizations began working together to save the remaining turtles through ambitious breeding programs and habitat restoration. Stiffer laws were enacted against illegal poaching, and former hunters who once raided turtle nests were employed to guard them. Their efforts are paying off. Over the past decades, over 200 royal turtles have been raised in captivity and released back into the wild, with more being hatched, raised, and released
released every year. Once back in the wild, the turtles are tagged with transmitters, allowing researchers to track their movements and behaviors in their natural habitat. Ultimately, the project's goal is to ensure the long-term survival of the royal turtle, protect its nesting areas, and raise awareness about other critically endangered species, bringing hope and healing to all the rivers of Southeast Asia. And this is Mandy from GoodNewsGoodPlanet.com.
Imperial Valley lithium boom raises hopes and concerns for locals. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In the Imperial Valley region of Southern California, deep groundwater reservoirs contain vast amounts of lithium. This mineral is critical for making batteries, and demand for it is growing as the electric car industry expands. Multiple companies are developing plans to extract that lithium, and one project has broken ground.
It's quite possible that this area is on the precipice of a major boom that could bring significant economic activity. But whether or not it actually benefits the residents is much more uncertain.
Manuel Pastor of the University of Southern California is co-author of a new book about the emerging lithium industry in the Imperial Valley and how it could affect the largely low-income Latino communities nearby. Local groups are pushing for companies to commit to strong environmental protections and to hiring and training residents for jobs the industry creates. And they help lobby for a tax on lithium extraction that will create significant revenue for communities. Pastor says these are steps in the right direction.
The fact that these companies have begun to fully realize that in order to do well, everybody in that region needs to do well gives me hope.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to a summer membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your